This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, May 11, 2004, at WBAI in New York. I'm Deepa Fernandez. General Taguba testifies but does not put blame for the torture of Iraqi prisoners on Defense Secretary Rumsfeld or General Richard Myers. Over the past 2 days, Venezuelan state security forces arrest over 100 Colombian paramilitary fighters on the outskirts of Caracas. And the Inter-American Court on Human Rights hears the case of Lori Berenson versus the Peruvian government. Their decision could set the New Yorker free. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. 7 Israeli soldiers were killed in a blast in the Gaza Strip this morning after a bomb exploded under an armored vehicle. As many as 100 people have been injured. The military wings of Hamas and Islamic Jihad claim responsibility for the action, which they say is in response to the Israeli military's current incursion. Salif Nasser, a community leader in the Gaza Strip, describes the Israeli military's most recent action in the occupied territory.
They destroyed some of the houses, some of the workshops, raising the agriculture land, uprooted the trees, killing more than six, injuring more than 100, and still the operation is going and they are escalating it.
Israeli military spokespersons say the most recent incursion, with 36 tanks and several dozen bulldozers, is to dismantle alleged sites of rocket-producing workshops. A United Nations relief worker says that the military's incursion may leave as many as 1,100 people homeless. Ralph Nader's presidential campaign filed a lawsuit against the state of Texas, claiming access rules to the ballot are unconstitutional. From KPFT in Houston, Renee Feltz reports.
Monday was the deadline for independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader to file petition signatures with the state and secure his place on the Texas presidential ballot in November. Instead, the Nader campaign filed a lawsuit challenging the ballot access law for independent candidates in Texas is unconstitutional. Nader campaign spokesman Kevin Zees.
First, because of the early due date, the earliest in the country, May 10th. 46 states have deadlines in July, August, September, and even later. Also unconstitutional to require independent candidates to collect 20,000 more signatures than third-party candidates, and also unconstitutional to require independent candidates to collect those signatures in 2 weeks less time.
Zees says Nader's ballot access lawsuit should be completed by the May 24th deadline for third-party candidates to submit petition signatures. From KPFT in Houston, Texas, I'm Renee Feltz for Free Speech Radio News.
Monsanto announced they are putting the brakes on their genetically modified wheat production. With more on the story, Kelly Ramirez.
Roundup Ready crops can survive heavy applications of Monsanto's Roundup brand herbicide, known generically as glyphosate. Farmers in North America already grow genetically modified corn, but with most corn used as animal feed, wheat was the first important food crop to undergo genetic modification. Many U.S. farmers have refused to grow GM wheat because overseas customers resist it. Half of the U.S. wheat crop is exported. Craig Culp is media director for the Center for Food Safety.
Monsanto calls this move a corporate realignment, but I think that the rest of us can see it as a full retreat on genetically engineered wheat. We've now shown that market rejection, consumer rejection, and farmer rejection can stymie the grandiose plans of big biotech companies.
With U.S. spring wheat acreage shrinking by 25% since 1997, Monsanto says it has better economic opportunities elsewhere. For FSRN, I'm Kelly Ramirez.
A California-based environmental advocacy group claims U.S. residents carry unhealthy levels of pesticides in their systems. From KPFA, Max Pringle reports.
The report culls data from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, which studied chemical levels in over 2,600 people nationwide. Several of the pesticides found have been linked to various medical problems, including infertility, birth defects, and childhood and adult cancers. The study, titled Chemical Trespass, Pesticides in Our Bodies and Corporate Accountability, makes the CDC data public for the first time. The Pesticide Action Network report focuses on pesticide levels found in blood and urine samples. Pesticide Action Network researchers say children, women, and Mexican Americans are disproportionately exposed. Children have less developed immune systems, women's physiology stores more of the chemicals in their bodies, and many Mexican Americans work in agriculture where pesticides are widely used. Children, for example, were found particularly vulnerable to nerve-damaging chlorpyrifos. The report says Dow Chemical makes over 80% of the chlorpyrifos found in humans. The company says people are exposed at levels too small to be harmful. But Monica Moore, co-director of Pesticide Action Network North America, says the data tells a different story.
A very interesting study has recently come out from Columbia in New York, which shows that after the EPA banned most home uses of chlorpyrifos, the birth weight of babies and the size of their heads, which are two sort of standard measures that are used to indicate the health of newborns, has gone up.
The study recommends that Congress investigate corporate responsibility for pesticide contamination, an EPA ban on using hazardous pesticides, and requiring manufacturers to demonstrate that a pesticide doesn't harm human health before it's used. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Max Pringle in Berkeley.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Today, General Antonia Taguba, whose report was uncovered by the New Yorker magazine detailing systemic abuses at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq, testified that the detainee abuses were due to a breakdown in leadership. But as Mitch Jeserich reports, he did not put responsibility for the breakdown on Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld or Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Richard Myers.
General Antonio Taguba, who investigated numerous abuses at Abu Ghraib that included rape and other humiliating abuses against Iraqi detainees, testified to the Senate Armed Forces Committee on his report that, along with photos aired on 60 Minutes 2, has spurred global outrage. Taguba put the blame for the abuses directly on the 800 Brigade that was responsible for Abu Ghraib.
Failure in leadership, sir, from the brigade commander on down, lack of discipline, no training whatsoever, and no supervision. Supervisory omission was rampant.
Taguba said that abuses at Abu Ghraib clearly violated international and U.S. law, but through questioning from lawmakers, beginning with Republican Senator John McCain, he did not hold the highest levels of the military responsible.
You found clearly in your report violations of the rules for the Geneva Conventions for treatment of prisoners of war, right?
Yes, sir.
Including moving prisoners around to avoid International Red Cross inspections?
Yes, sir. That was conveyed to us by those that we interviewed.
In your report, General Karpinski says that General Sanchez said that in the case of problems in the prison, there was uprising and riot, escape, an American, I believe, was killed, that they should use lethal means immediately and not non-lethal means to start with. Isn't that according to your report?
Yes, sir. They changed their rules of engagement, I believe, four times to use lethal and then to non-lethal to lethal force based on the levels of the events.
Senator Byrd.
It's becoming clear to me that this abuse wasn't just about values. It was about policies and planning. General Taguba, based on your investigation, who gave the order to soften up these prisoners?
Sir, we did not find any evidence of a policy or a direct order given to these soldiers to conduct what they did. We didn't find any order whatsoever, sir, written or otherwise, that directed them to do what they did.
Doesn't the lack of training of our troops for prison duty actually demonstrate a monumental failure in planning for the long-term occupation of Iraq? How else could the military and civilian leadership of the Pentagon explain why this training wasn't even offered?
Sir, the training of the Geneva Convention is inherent. Everything, every time we, from as a recruit all the way up to my rank level.
Taguba was originally slated to be the sole panelist for a morning hearing, but due to objections by the Pentagon, the committee also took testimony from Under Secretary of Defense for Intelligence Stephen Cambone and Lieutenant General Lance Smith. The hearing largely focused on Secretary Cambone and how the Bush administration views the Geneva Conventions. At issue was the administration sending Jeffrey Miller, who once oversaw Guantanamo Bay detainees, to head the prison system in Iraq, where Carbone told the committee that unlike Guantanamo Bay, detainees in Iraq are protected under the Geneva Accords, and that what happened in Abu Ghraib was a violation of policy.
We are currently investigating why some soldiers at Abu Ghraib did not abide by those understood procedures and guidelines.
You have decided right from the beginning that the Geneva Conventions would apply to our activities in Iraq.
Yes, sir.
Democratic Senator Carl Levin is the ranking Democrat on the committee.
And yet, Secretary Rumsfeld repeatedly has made a distinction between whether or not those Geneva Convention rules must be applied, whether people, prisoners, will be treated, quote, pursuant to those rules or consistent with those rules. And he said, and this is just a few days ago, that the Geneva Convention did not apply precisely.
Human rights groups have expressed concern that the perception of the U.S. skirting the Geneva Accords would encourage others to do the same. At airtime, CNN reported the first possible retaliation to Abu Ghraib abuses. A video displayed on a website shows a militant group beheading an American contractor in Iraq who has been identified as Nicholas Berg of Pennsylvania. Mitch Jezerich, Free Speech Radio News.
As we go to air today, CNN is reporting that a video has been discovered on a website that the news network says is linked to Al-Qaeda, which shows a man who identifies himself as an American being beheaded in Iraq. CNN reports that in the video, the captors say the United States refused to exchange him for prisoners in the Abu Ghraib prison. The American is shown sitting in front of five hooded men. After the statement is read by one of the men, the victim is pushed to the floor and, amid his screams, his throat is cut. Finally, one of the captors holds up the man's severed head. Again, this report is yet to be confirmed by the State Department. We'll have more on this story as it unfolds tomorrow. Meanwhile, independent investigations of Iraqi detainees by Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch conclude that abuse and torture have not been isolated, but in fact systemic. In July of 2003, Amnesty issued its first report documenting widespread use of torture and other ill treatment by coalition forces. Human Rights Watch said the treatment of Iraqi detainees stems from an atmosphere of impunity cultivated in the Bush administration. They conclude that orders to relax or ignore international norms originated with the treatment of prisoners in Afghanistan and Guantanamo Bay in Cuba, and became more widespread during the occupation of Iraq. Martha Baskin investigates further.
We've been following abuses ever since people were interned in Guantanamo Bay, when the administration decided that detainees would not be subject to the Geneva Convention, and we've been following that closely. In 2002, we very closely looked at some abuses at the Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan, where, in fact, American military investigators have stated that two deaths of Afghanis were homicides. We still await the military's report on that. And in Iraq, we've had a number of witness testimonies about a variety of levels of poor treatment, potentially torture, inhumane, cruel, and degrading punishment.
Mark Alasco, senior military analyst at Human Rights Watch, confirms that abuse of Iraqi detainees was systemic and documented as early as the summer of 2003, an accusation initially made public by the International Committee of the Red Cross. Previously, Alasco was an intelligence officer on Iraq at the Pentagon for almost 7 years.
The problem is that for some reason the world has not seen witness statements to be on the level of photography. Unless you have a picture, people don't feel that you have evidence. And it's very sad. I don't know if it is a level of racism, the belief that an Iraqi or an Afghani cannot possibly tell you what torture is, cannot possibly be telling the truth. This is not what Americans do. Or if it's a level of hubris, but, you know, this is not new.
Amnesty International has also documented the use of torture and abuse in several reports sent to the U.S. government, coalition forces, and the Coalition Provisional Authority. Like Human Rights Watch, Amnesty says torture has been systemic since the war on terror began.
So
what we have at the very highest levels, from President Bush to Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld to commanders at the camps, presumption of innocence is out the window. Everyone is labeled a terrorist, a hardcore killer. That's the message that every soldier has, just as anyone who's watching TV has.
Safeguards to prevent torture, such as the right to challenge one's detention and the right to independent monitoring, have been denied by the administration in Iraq, Guantanamo, and Afghanistan, according to Coluccio. Equally disturbing to observers is the fact that on April 30th, Major General Jeffrey Miller was put in charge of U.S.-run prisons in Iraq. Miller has recently acknowledged the use of some 50 coercive techniques during interrogation, although he said late last week that prisoners will no longer be hooded, sleep-deprived, or forced to stand for lengthy periods. That's not good enough for Francis Boyle.
General Miller should be relieved of his command immediately, and a full-scale investigation should be opened up with respect to him on the basis of his own statements and also on the basis of the Taguba report.
Boyle, professor of law at the University of Illinois, is author of the new book Destroying World Order, U.S. Imperialism in the Middle East Before and After September 11th. Ordering military personnel to soften up detainees for intelligence gathering, says Boyle, is in violation of standing army directives, the Geneva Conventions, the Convention Against Torture, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and various U.S. criminal codes. But so far, prosecution has been reserved for soldiers and reservists by the military's own criminal justice system. Jordan Paust, Law Foundation professor at the University of Houston, was a captain on the faculty of the Army's Judge Advocate General School during Vietnam. Paust says there are too many violations of human rights law and the Geneva Conventions built into the Military Commission's rules of procedure and evidence to see justice done. Paust says civilians and former military accused of torture could be prosecuted under U.S. code in the federal district courts. The U.S. has an obligation to engage in good faith efforts to either initiate prosecution or to extradite persons reasonably accused of war crimes.
You can't just look the other way. You can't say, I leave it to the military to handle military reprimands and prosecutions. As the leader of the country, the president has a duty to make sure the attorney general exercises the attorney general's duty to initiate prosecution or extradite. He has the power to do so, and he also has the responsibility to do so, especially under the U.S. Constitution, Article 2, Section 3. The president has the duty faithfully to execute the law.
Absent persistent outcry by the public and Congress, however, retribution for war crimes may remain limited to those who carried out the orders rather than those who orchestrated them. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Martha Baskin reporting.
You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandes. For an archive of today's newscast or previous FSRN stories, go to www.fsrn.org. That's www.fsrn.org. Over the past 2 days, Venezuelan state security forces have arrested over 100 Colombian paramilitary fighters on the outskirts of the Venezuelan capital city, Caracas. These arrests were the results of an investigation into alleged Colombian paramilitary activity with ties to Venezuela's radical opposition to destabilize the leftist government of President Hugo Chavez. Greg Wilpert for FSRN has the story in Caracas.
In an early Sunday morning raid on a farm, state security forces arrested over 80 paramilitary fighters in Venezuela. Yesterday, more were arrested and many are presumed to have escaped. The raid was the result of a month-long investigation into the activities of the farm's owner, Roberto Alonso, a Cuban exile who has ties to radical elements of Venezuela's opposition. One of the captured Colombian paramilitary fighters explained how he says they were tricked into coming to Venezuela and into becoming a paramilitary fighting force.
No, yo en este momento le puedo informar que nos trajeron aquí para Venezuela.
At this moment, I can tell you that we're brought here to Venezuela to make a paramilitary group with this Cuban man who is the owner of this farm and who would pay us 500,000 Colombian pesos for our work. Then, once we got here, they told us that they would take us to another location where we would take over some posts of the National Guard. I don't know which.
Another of the paramilitary fighters told the press that they were to use the weapons they would steal from the National Guard to later attack the presidential palace or the president's residence.
They brought us here from Colombia. Once here, they tricked us. They told us we were supposed to attack two objectives. I think the first was the presidential palace, Miraflores, and the other, I think, was the presidential residence.
Venezuela's opposition has presented mixed reactions to the arrests, with most, though, expressing skepticism about them, suggesting that the arrests were staged by the government in order to discredit the opposition. César Pérez Vivas, an opposition legislator, made fun of the raid.
With this splendid victory against the paramilitary in Hatillo, the United Nations should be thinking of contracting Defense Minister General García Cornejo for deactivating paramilitary forces that affect countries around the world. They managed to detect terrorists without weapons.
Government officials reacted angrily to the opposition's complacency with regard to a paramilitary fighting force being trained to overthrow the government. The officer in charge of making the arrest said the following.
If we, as part of the government, had staged all of this, then we should be competing for the Oscar Prize.
Venezuela's Vice President, José Vicente Rangel, called on the U.S. government and the Organization of American States to issue a statement, especially considering how quick they have been to back opposition accusations against the government.
Listen well, Mr. Shapiro. I ask you directly to say what is the position of your government. The State Department is issuing statements every day against Venezuela. Every day it accuses the Chavez government of supporting terrorism. Every day it connects the Chavez government with the Colombian guerrilla and Colombian violence.
Juan Barreto, a pro-Chavez legislator, explained how the strategy to bring paramilitaries into Venezuela is part of what he says is a larger plan to destabilize Venezuela and to overthrow the Chavez government with U.S. support.
In order to stop Venezuela, they say that it is necessary to penetrate it militarily, and for this they must take the Colombian conflict into Venezuela. This is what they call the continentalization of the war. In order to heat up the Colombian conflict and thus achieve that the United States can bring more people and resources into Colombia, and can thereby solve what they call the Venezuelan problem.
The arrest of the Colombian paramilitary forces in Venezuela's capital represents yet another twist in the Venezuelan conflict. It is sure to heighten tensions between the government and the opposition as the country gets ready for the recertification of signatures in the petition for a recall referendum against President Chavez that could be held in early August. Greg Wilpert reporting for Free Speech Radio News from Caracas, Venezuela.
The year 2000 census found that Latinos are the largest ethnic population in the United States. At that time, they made up almost 40% of the U.S. population, and that number is steadily rising. Florida has the fourth largest Hispanic population in the country, and this year the Latino community is increasingly aware of their power to affect the future of America. The major political parties have stepped up efforts to appeal to what they see as the swing vote, which may determine who controls Congress and the White House. But while community members are spreading awareness and a sense of responsibility so that people can use their political power wisely, many in the Hispanic community are struggling to find candidates that really speak to their needs. Andrew Stelzer reports from Tampa.
Ana Rodriguez started doing community organizing with Buena Vista this January in Texas. Working out of Austin, she registered voters and promoted the nonpartisan group's goals, which include better health care, education, and participation in government. She came to the Tampa Bay area in March to organize and set up a Buena Vista office in Florida. She spends her days training volunteers and going door-to-door in neighborhoods with large Hispanic populations.
When you go to someone's door, more likely than not, they've experienced job loss in their families. They've experienced trouble getting adequate health care. There's a heightened sense of political awareness. I find that people are overwhelmingly registered to vote and planning on voting. People are not satisfied.
But politicians' efforts to appear as friends to Latino voters have been little more than attempts to grab headlines. In January came President Bush's short-lived proposal to allow undocumented workers temporary permits. In April, Governor Jeb Bush proposed to give driver's licenses to illegal immigrants. Within 3 weeks, the proposal had all but disappeared. Community members saw it for what it was, a plan meant to go nowhere. In early May, several congressmen gathered in Miami to announce a new immigration plan that was so far-reaching even its supporters admit it has no chance of passing. According to Diana Balzalar, a Buena Vista volunteer, the focus on immigration issues shows a lack of understanding of the almost 3 million Latino voters in Florida.
Healthcare, education, housing, and also jobs. They are so worried about those issues.
Politicians on the campaign trail are not addressing any of these issues, despite polls that consistently show Latinos feel it is the government's responsibility to provide citizens with adequate education and health care. In fact, the refusal of government to address the community's priorities has forced 14 of Florida's state senators and representatives to form a Hispanic Legislative Caucus. The Hispanic Caucus's members have roots in several countries, including Cuba, Puerto Rico, Spain, Mexico, and Colombia. Made up of Democrats and Republicans, the group plans to vote as a bloc on issues involving health disparities, adult literacy, and unemployment. But the need to create a Hispanic caucus reveals just how powerless the people feel, despite their numbers. Ivan Manez agreed to register to vote, but was skeptical about what it will accomplish.
People usually just go day by day. I don't think they feel that things for them will change, depending on who's in power and who's doing what.
What do you think?
I mean, I'm only 23, so I mean, I really don't care, to tell you the truth.
And when you see politicians on the TV or read something in the paper, do you feel like they're talking to you?
No, I feel talking a bunch of ish.
Balzalar, who is from Peru, tries to convince skeptics, but whether her words have an effect won't be known until November.
And I say, you know, you have the possibility to vote. I don't. I don't have that possibility. And if the politicians see that we are a number, a big number, they're going to begin to take care of us.
One group that has been taken care of is Cuban Republicans. 31% of Florida's Latinos are Cuban, and in 2000, 80% of them voted for George Bush. Anti-Castro policies are an easy way to maintain the support of those who fled Cuba. But a generation gap may be evolving. As younger Cubans are growing up in Florida, they have no firsthand distaste for Fidel. In an effort to reach these and other Latino voters, the Bush administration handpicked former Housing and Urban Development Secretary Mel Martinez, who is Cuban, to run for Florida's open Senate seat. So far, Martinez's speeches have not strayed in the slightest from the Bush administration's company line. But Rodriguez says the tactic is transparent.
So this gentleman, Mel Martinez, is advocating for Bush, and the belief in that strategy is that people will not only vote for Bush, but they'll vote for Martinez as well. That has proven to undermine people's intelligence and people's capacity to make distinctions between candidates. Latinos do not just vote by name recognition, and they don't just vote the way that people tell them to.
Rodriguez saw the same scenario unfold in her native Texas in 2002, when Tony Sanchez ran for governor. He was well-funded by the Republican Party and would have been Texas's first Latino governor.
Tony Sanchez thought that people were dumb enough to just recognize a Latino last name and vote for him. And the people are not dumb. People do know the power of numbers and how we're going to be the majority soon and how that can't be ignored.
For Free Speech Radio News from Tampa, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica stations WBAI in New York, KPFA in Berkeley, and KPFK in Los Angeles, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. Our producers are Monica Lopez and Simba Russo. Headlines editors are Randy Zimmerman and Nell Abram. Our DC editor is Mitch Jeserich. Our technical production team is Jade Paget-Seekins, Pauline Bartolone, Mick Mylan, and Lindsay Benedict. We have help from Eric Klein and Amma Bwadi. Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective. To find out more, or for our archives, visit www.fsrn.org. That's www.fsrn.org. I'm Deepa Fernandez.